Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore in some of our favorite video games. I'm your host, Joe Perez, one of several lore-focused folks from Blizzard Watch, and I've got my stupendous co-host with me today. Some would say he's even an icon, Matt Rossi. How are you doing today, Matt?
Who the heck would say that?
I mean, we were talking about it yesterday on our lovely Tavern Watch podcast, which if you haven't been listening to it, you should. We just had a lovely interview with Brendan Conway from Magpie Games, in which Matt got to ask a whole bunch of questions about masks, and we got to talk about the new upcoming Avatar game. It was fantastic stuff. So
I don't recall anyone calling me an icon. It's like, geez, you need better icons.
I don't know about that. But today we're not going to be talking about anything like that. We are going to be talking about the next step in our dungeon and raid series. And we're going to be talking about two more raids from the Burning Crusade. In particular, we're going to be talking about Magtheridon's Lair and Gruul's Lair, which were some of the earliest raid content that you could actually get through. And I think we'll start with Magtheridon's Lair. So Magtheridon is a character that has a pretty long history in the Warcraft franchise, at least going back to Warcraft 3, if I remember correct. Mm-hmm. And I believe that was one of the items that happened where Ner'zhul opened up a whole bunch of portals, and out comes this wonderful Magtheridon. So,
well, actually, no.
Oh, please correct me.
Basically, what happened was Ner'zhul opened a bunch of portals, ripped Draenor into pieces.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
One relatively big piece of it ended up floating in the Twisting Nether. Then the Legion themselves opened portals onto it because it was in the Nether, and thus much easier to get to. The portals that Ner'zhul opened only tangentially were related to that. They were using the same framework, but it was the Legion who opened them much later. And Magtheridon came forth onto the shattered chunk of Draenor that's now called Outland and took it over in the name of the Legion. Magtheridon was the replacement for Manaroth as Master of the Pit Lines, the Pit Lords.
Pit Lords, yep.
So it's kind of true, but it skips a step if you say that he came through. He didn't just come through. Ner'zhul didn't just open portals and then out comes Manaroth. Ner'zhul opened portals. The planet started to implode. He jumped through one, and we'll get back to that. And as a result, the world was shattered, and the pieces that were left in the Nether were taken over by the Legion, and specifically Magtheridon.
In point of fact, I believe that Magtheridon actually, after conquering the Outland world, which at this point is Outland, no longer Draenor, because it has been shattered into a thousand pieces, used the Black Temple as a seat of power. Is that correct? Am I correct in remembering that?
It's kind of like the Black Temple, yes, but the problem is that in Warcrafts 2 and 3, the Black Temple and Hellfire are used almost synonymously, and it wasn't until later games where they actually sat down and said, okay, which one is where? Are they, they're not the same place, so which one's where? So yes, in the version we currently have, Megtheridon ruled from the Black Temple. It was his fortress. And Hellfire Citadel was essentially where he was making new servants. He was making what we call Chaos Orcs or Fel Orcs.
Fel Orcs, yep.
Yeah.
So for those of you that don't remember, the Orcs of the old Draenor days, and we're talking about like the members of the Horde, there was this whole thing where they drank demonic blood and got corrupted. That is an oversimplification of it, but that process was continued by, in this case, Megtheridon, as he was creating his army to basically lock in and keep Outland for the Legion. And those forces included all sorts of manner of things, such as nether dragons, void walkers, succubi, Felguard, Felbeast, Doomguard. Eredar were actually present here. And I think it was the first time that we had really seen Eredar, which makes a certain amount of sense considering that it is Draenor and involving, you know, all of the Draenei that they probably would have really, really wanted to get their little greedy reddish hands on, as well as.
Although we should point out that one of the most powerful Eredar on Outland was Sokrathar, and Sokrathar was a Draenei convert.
Yes.
He wasn't one of the ones that converted back when Kil'jaeden and Archimonde first did. He came later.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit? Or?
Well, no, not really, because what I want to do is give people a real brief rundown of the situation before everything goes to heck. Essentially, Megtheridon he rules Outland. The place is essentially his. Anybody who's not ruled by him is hiding from him. For instance, the remaining Draenei at this time were literally hiding in a swamp.
Yep.
It's now Tel'Rador. There were some broken that were living in the swamp as well, but those broken were not welcome in the Draenei settlements, and as a result, because the Draenei were afraid that they'd catch being broken, because they had no idea what had caused it. They didn't know how it came to be, and we do now know, but we didn't at the time.
Yeah, this is one of those things where they sort of clarified it, because back in Warcraft 3, when we first met the Broken, we were told that that was corruption due to the exposure to Fel. Turns out that's not the case.
Yeah. So they had no idea where it came from or how to stop it. So they isolated themselves from the Broken. As a result, the Broken had to start their own societies and develop their own culture because they weren't being allowed into the Draenei one anymore, with a couple of rare exceptions, like Nobundu. And while that was going on, while the Draenei were hiding, while the Broken were hiding, the Broken had developed a kind of stealth ability, very similar to the Elven Shadowmeld, because it was called Shadowmeld at the time. While that was going on, a certain elf named Illidan showed up on Outland, and he did so essentially to avoid Kil'jaeden, who was angry with him.
He was serving him at this time, right? Like this is
not him. Anymore. No.
He had just broken free of that.
Yeah, he had been given the task when he first consumed the Skull of Gul'dan and gained his demonic power. He got the attention of Kil'jaeden, who basically sought him out and said, okay, up till now, this has been kind of cute, but now I'm upset. So here's what's going to happen. You're going to do a favor for me. I've kind of lost control of a tool. It's not doing what I was led to expect it would do. And so I want you to destroy it for me. And once you've done that, then I won't destroy you, and I won't hunt you down for, you know, killing one of my people and stealing power that was meant for us and otherwise doing things I didn't want you to do. Now, Illidan, no, recognizing, there's an old saying, game respects game, or like understands like.
Mm-hmm.
Illidan knew full well that Kil'jaeden couldn't be trusted.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't trust Illidan.
It's a thing you can smell your own kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Illidan, you know, has a goal, and he's willing to do anything to meet that goal. And he knew in Kil'jaeden he had met a guy who was even worse than he was about it. Kil'jaeden just betrays people because he thinks it's fun. So yeah, I'm not trusting this guy, but I'm also kind of out of options. So he tried to get something called the Eye of Sargeras out of the Tomb of Sargeras and use it at a certain locus of power in Northern Lordaeron to destroy the Lich King. And he got pretty far. He was actually successfully using it. Unfortunately, his brother's wife / girlfriend and Illidan's ex, you know, love of his life, and a couple of other people showed up and stopped him before he could use the eye to destroy the Lich King, because it was destroying the forest around Lordaeron, which Illidan was like, so what? It's going to, yeah, there's going to be some devastation, but it'll stop that thing. And that thing is more important to stop. So I don't care. But, you know, not knowing what he was doing, and probably wouldn't have cared anyway, Malfurion was like, think of the trees, you maniac, and stop them. There was more actually cool epic speech here. That wasn't like actually literally think of the trees, but you get what I'm saying.
I always wondered about that too, because like it always seemed like one of those very short-sighted things. Like, would the forest have been able to have been recovered by the legion of druids at the command of Malfurion? Is this something that could have been brought back or walked back?
He had no idea what Illidan was doing.
But instead of asking, he just goes, no, don't do this. Bad.
Oh, no, he doesn't say, no, don't do this. Bad. He had just, heard that Taranda had fallen away and was dead. So he was not thinking very clearly. He thought Illidan killed Taranda. So he shows up. Illidan's using this powerful relic to just wreak untold devastation on the area for no reason Malfurion understands, and has already killed, like, you know, the love of his life. Yeah, no, Malfurion was not in a let's chat mood, especially since he didn't want Illidan free in the first place. Illidan made a pact with demons and turned into this monstrosity. Before that, he betrayed their people 10,000 years ago and recreated the Well of Eternity that had almost destroyed the planet. Malfurion and Illidan were not on speaking terms. So the idea that Malfurion would have stopped and said, oh, hey, what are you doing, bro? No. As far as Malfurion was concerned, his brother was a dangerous deviant who'd proven himself willing to consort with monstrous powers. And in his defense,
he's right.
Illidan was consorting with monstrous powers at this exact moment. Anyway, turned out Taranda wasn't dead. Turned out Maiev had kind of let her fall into the water because Maiev didn't care about anything but vengeance against Illidan. Turned out Illidan was trying to destroy the Lich King. Whether or not he could have repaired the forest afterwards, I got no idea. If you look at the forest in Lordaeron today, I think it would have been a bit more complicated than you're saying.
Sure.
But, you know, I don't know. It's one of those things that, who knows? But what we do know is the two brothers ended this face off. They both went off to rescue Taranda. The eye was stopped. The forests weren't destroyed. And in the end, Malfurion and Illidan came to a kind of, all right, I'll stay out of your way. You stay out of my way. That works for me. All right. We've hated each other for thousands of years, but from my perspective, brother, and this is Illidan talking, I don't want us to hate each other anymore. It's not what I want. So I'm just going to go. And Malfurion's like, okay. Maiev is like, F no, you are not going to get to just go. But he does, because he's Illidan, he knows how to leave, and she has to chase him. At the same time, Vash, who was working with Illidan, had caught up to a guy named Kael'thas Sunstrider, mm-hmm. who is the lord of the Blood Elves. He had been the prince of the High Elves, but now, after Arthas's little march through to the Sunwell, a huge amount of High Elves had died. The remainder had changed their name to Blood Elves to honor the sacrifice of their former people. And they were all suffering greatly from magical addiction. Vash told Kael, after Kael decided the Alliance couldn't be trusted because they were all horribly racist, which, as far as he could tell, was true. Garathos was the human he was dealing with, and Garathos was horribly racist. So at this point, do you want to go from here with Kael, or do you want me to keep going?
I mean, feel free to keep going.
Okay. Kael'thas basically, after almost being executed inside Dalaran for, you know, trying to win through the impossible task Garathos was giving him by accepting the help of the Naga, because Kael was a high elf, they had vague rumors about the Naga. They didn't actually know about them. The Kaldari did, but they'd been separated from the Kaldari for 10,000 years.
Yeah, so this is back. Don't forget, they had been separated out, and we're talking they live in Silvermoon. They live on a completely separate continent, all the way across the other side of the world, isolated from the Kaldari, who have basically shut themselves off from society.
And also think about the fact that Kael'thas was Kael'thas Sunstrider. His father was an Asterion Sunstrider. His grandfather was apparently Dathramar Sunstrider.
Mm-hmm.
Dathramar Sunstrider was a Highborn. That's where the High Elves get their name from. It's also every single one of the Naga used to be Highborn. They just were the Highborn that stayed loyal to Ashara. Dathramar was a Highborn who was okay, we've gone a little too far for me. I'm going to kind of pull back. So they had cultural ties. Vash could say, you know, we're not so different. My people and your people, we were once the same. And Kael'thas knew that if he tried doing the things Garthos wanted, he was going to get all of his people killed. Like, he had a cadre of blood elves with him, and they were all going to die. So he started taking Vash's help. Garthos found out, tried to have him executed. So now Kael'thas had nothing to lose. He'd met Taranda and Malfurion, and they were impressive, but they weren't really interested in helping him.
Which is a theme that you see repeated later on as well. Like, it's the idea that the Night Elves at this point were, again, sort of still not part of society, had no interest in reintegrating with the High Elves because, again, they still had that, at this point, a really healthy distrust of anything arcane. So, like, they had watched their society crumble under the weight of arcane addiction and what it brought and basically the hell that Azshara wrought upon their people. So why are they going to welcome it back? There's no incentive for Kael'thas to actually join forces with them at this point.
Yeah, like, for one thing, Kael'thas is the grandson of the guy that nearly blew up the world again.
Yeah.
Because Dathramar led a revolt that, you know, unleashed a magical storm upon what was then Kalimdor, the new Kalimdor to the west. And the people that had to banish him were the two people he was talking to. Like, these are people who were contemporary with his grandpa.
Yeah, so they remember everything.
Yeah, they're like, no, we accept that you are related to us, but we have no interest in what you do with arcane magic. That's, you want to give it up, feel free to quit, go through withdrawal, and you can come live in the forest with us. But since that doesn't look like something you're going to do, have fun. So Vash is like, Vash was very successful in hiding herself from those two, because if they'd seen her, it wouldn't have gone well. But she's like,
Vash is a master of spies in Shadowlands. Yeah. Just throwing it out there.
Vash is like, look, I know you're kind of like trying to help your people here, and that's great. Helping your people is wonderful. I know a guy totally likes magic way more than even your grandpa did.
A whole lot of ritual stuff too.
Yeah. Super, super knowledgeable about it. He might be able to help you. And I'm just saying, it would be getting your people away from this, which is kind of nasty. And you got those humans might still try and kill you. So yeah, I'm thinking you should come with. And so Kael'thas did go with Vash to Outland, where Illidan had also gone because he had just failed to use the Eye of Sargeras to destroy the Lich King. And he was like, okay, I need a place I can secure against the Legion. This place would work really well if I can just get these portals closed. And he's like, this is when Vash brings Kael'thas to Illidan. And they're like, okay, first up, what are the problems? Well, and they break down what the problems are. The first problem is that there's these portals where the Legion can summon endless reinforcements.
There are four major portals in particular.
Yeah. As long as those portals are up, Magtheridon has a practically limitless army. He can just you kill demons, they just come back. So that's problem one. Problem two is Magtheridon himself, who is not quite the fighter Manoroth was, which puts him still way out of the weight class of almost everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Manoroth was astonishingly powerful. I mean, of the people in the Legion, the only people that Manoroth feared were Archimonde and
Kil'jaeden,
and possibly Sargeras, although that's the kind of situation where, like, literally everybody feared Sargeras, so that makes sense. So Magtheridon is up there in power, and he's going to be a pretty formidable fight. However, Kil'jaeden is much worse, so Illidan is willing to risk it, because he thinks, if I can beat him like I beat, bloody heck, who's the guy he beat? The one he beat when he drained the skull.
Gul'dan?
No.
I know what you're talking about, but...
Yeah, the demon lord. He's one of the Nazrathism, but I can't remember his bloody name. So Tychondrius and Illidan fought, and Illidan killed him. So Illidan was feeling like, I like my chances. I mean, maybe I can't win, but with you guys and your blood elf soldiers and your Naga soldiers, I'm thinking there's at least a chance here if we can get them portals closed. And Kael'thas, who had a certain knowledge of magic himself, was like, yeah, I think the portals are definitely attackable. So they put together a plan. And as they were going through all the broken, who were being, you know, exploited and attacked by the Legion pretty constantly, and their leader, Akama, saw Illidan and his people fighting off the demons and thought, okay, we'll make a deal. And so they got a force of Broken to join them as well, which meant they now had stealth assassins because the Broken could like stealth around a lot. They were like Draenei, but rogues. But partially because they had feet now. The Draenei, as they become Broken, their hooves break down and they actually turn into toes. You've also seen that in various kinds of Eredar. So that's an interesting thing to consider. Different kinds of corruption. In the case of the Eredar, it's fell corruption, can give certain kinds of Eredar or Eredar adjacent beings toes, whereas Draenei obviously have hooves, as do some of the Eredar. The original Eredar had hooves. Anyway, getting back to what we're talking about, this is what they spend the next while doing, attacking various portals and shutting them down so that no reinforcements can come through. Once they have the four portals shut down, that's when they advance on the Black Temple.
Mm-hmm. And so this is the siege of the Black Temple, the original siege of the Black Temple after basically it's been taken by the Legion. So
yeah, the Legion turned Karabor into the Black Temple. Now this is the first time someone's attacked it since then.
So you have the combined efforts of Illidan's forces, which we now know are, you know, varied and, you know, consist of various, you know, demonically aligned things. Whether or not they were demon hunters at this time, I think is still kind of gray. I don't even think they explained it in the Illidan novel.
No, they weren't. They straight up weren't.
So then you have the Blood Elves, which are at this point still arcane masterful. You have the army of the Naga that's under control of Lady Vash, who are incredible hunters, incredible bow, like rangers, essentially. And then you have the Ash Tongue tribe of the Broken under the leadership of Akama, who are just going around being full on rogues and able to like stealth up behind things and just completely shut it down. So after the dimensional gateways are shut down, Magtheridon doesn't have his reinforcements. He has no way out. He has no way to bring anything back in. And honestly, at this point, like it's a last-ditch effort on his part. So Magtheridon, go ahead.
I will say he does almost win.
He like does, yeah.
He goes up against this whole force, and he does almost win. But in the end, Illidan takes him down. Because Illidan's got the Warglaives of Azanoth, he's killed big demon lords before. He knows how to do this. So combine that with the demonic power he'd stolen from the Skull of Gul'dan, and yeah, it ultimately ends with Illidan defeating Magtheridon. And go ahead.
I was going to say, it's not by himself, though. This needs to be clear. It's with the help of Kael'thas, Lady Vash, and Akama all assisting. Illidan does, claim victory, but it's all four of them that have to work together in order to do it. So
yeah, that's absolutely true. But literally, they get Magtheridon down and like instantly Kil'jaeden just pops in.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not something that Illidan had expected to happen. And Kil'jaeden's like, yeah, okay, you beat him. That's cute. Remember that conversation we had about you doing a thing for me? It isn't done yet. I'm not sure what you were doing here. Perhaps you got confused. I'm not sure. I can see it being hard for you to sort it all out. So I'm going to try this again. Go kill that thing I have a problem with, or I will destroy you. Okay? Are we good now? And Illidan, realizing, oh yeah, I am not in a good position here, says, yep, all right, that's fine. I was just getting myself a power base for my second attempt. Everything's good. And each of them gives the other the look saying, yeah, okay. But Illidan begins moving to do that. But before he leaves, the first thing he does is realize, okay, I need an army. And yeah. I need it desperately.
And this is where Magtheridon starts coming in.
Yeah. Magtheridon is the central point of his first plan. Because the first thing he does is reach out to all the orcs that were already serving. Magtheridon says, I just kicked your boy's butt. You're mine now.
And they, of course, go, okay, yeah, because that's the way their society operates. The strongest is in charge, essentially. So, cool.
And Illidan's very demon-y at this point. And they're used to taking orders from demons. But they're like, okay, but what happens when we need to convert more of our people? Now that, are you going to use your blood to... And he's like, no. You don't get my blood. That's what this big lump of tar I just kicked the crap out of is for.
Yeah, so...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, it's very, very distinct in the fact that Magtheridon is not killed. Illidan defeats him, does not kill him, and instead has him dragged to, at this point, what they've now specified as Hellfire Citadel, where there is a prison slash laboratory slash factory for orcs being constructed within the walls of the Citadel, and where the Magtheridon is kept at the brink of death and locked using physical chains and arcane chains and things that look like lament configurations all around him. And every single day, Illidan's folks go in, take his blood, take it to another wing inside of the Hellfire Citadel, and make more fell orcs as they're strapped to a table and injected with demonic blood. And so we get our lovely army of red, very aggressive, spiky orcs that you get to see all throughout Burning Crusade, and especially in the Hellfire Peninsula.
And you'll note that they're significantly more mutated than the orcs who drank the blood from Manoroth originally.
Yeah, like the ones from Manoroth just turned green and got more aggressive.
Yeah, but these ones are actually, their faces are starting to grow massive, like orc tusks are like maybe at the most 4 or 5 inches. The spikes coming out of the fell or chaos orc faces are like 1.5 feet long. Like it's a wonder they can close their mouths at all.
And some of them can't.
Yeah, and they're getting big and red. They are very heavily mutated.
It's very similar to like the troll berserkers, right? The big giant brutes that we wind up seeing. They're starting to get to that sort of level. Not all of them, but there is that level of mutation, and you do see and face that quite a bit. Which we'll come back when we talk about Black Temple. There's more there to it as well, but it is an absolute case of 100% corrupted blood breeding this huge force of rage and power and mutation and making them way more deadly to deal with. And that's where we come in. So as we wind up getting to Hellfire Peninsula and we start figuring out what's going on, we start learning that Magtheridon is alive and still stuck in being used to this purpose. And our job at this point is to canonically break through all the different wings of Hellfire Citadel, from the ramparts down into the why can't I think of it, the Blood Furnace, I think it is, the Blood Furnace where everything is being converted arcanely to make more of them.
And then the Shattered Halls, where they're being trained.
And the Shattered Halls, which is their barracks and training facility, down to the source of Magtheridon's lair, where it's not really a lair, but the prison, where not only do we have to defeat all of the jailers that are keeping him in check, but we also have to kill him. Because if we don't, he's just going to either A, break free and start trying to take over Outland again, and we don't really need that. There's already enough demons running rampant through Hellfire Peninsula, and he's got definitely a bone to pick with pretty much everybody at this point, or we kill him and risk him going back to where demons go. But he's out of the hands of Illidan at this point and can no longer be leveraged or used in this manner to continue to make fell orcs.
It's worth pointing out, though, to get there, we have to fight our way through a lot of fell orcs.
A lot.
And we have to kill Kargath Bladefist himself.
Yep.
Who is one of the top, one of the original orc war chiefs, warlords who was fighting in the Horde against the Alliance in the First and Second War. Kargath was not allowed to go to Azeroth because he was too unstable.
And he's even more unstable now because now he's a fell orc.
Yeah, now he's got, you know, like I said, the teeth. Yeah, he's got teeth that you look at him and you go, how does he close his mouth? Like, seriously, what's going on? Like, because not only does he have the giant tusks coming up from his lower jaw, he has big ones coming down from his upper jaw.
And you know how he had, like, one hand that had been taken in gladiatorial combat and how he got his name Blade Fist by having a blade stuck to his fist? Yeah, his other hand is now no longer there and is replaced with an axe.
Yeah, he chose to do that this time.
By choice,
he cut off his other hand. You kill him. That's just to get through all the places and get the proper means to get into the the Manoroth lair. And as Joe just pointed out, you have to fight the various guards and jailers and magicians who are holding him.
Warlocks.
Yeah, the warlocks. And then once you do that, he gets loose and you got to fight him. And, you know, he was at the time, it was a 25-person raid fight only, which was the highest raid level in Burning Crusade. And it's really, I remember this fight. It was hard until you finally got the timing on those stupid cubes. It was really hard. It was not an easy fight. It was definitely as an intro fight, it was pretty significant.
Agreed. Yeah. It was one of those things where, like, it out of the lore of it, but, like, in the it sort of fit the mechanics in this particular case because it was supposed to be absolutely ridiculously hard because that was supposed to be what Magtheridon was. And even then, we're fighting him as a shadow of his former self, where he's weakened, he's been imprisoned, he's been basically beaten up every single day with his blood being taken, and he still is a handful. And that's sort of the point, right? It's the mechanics of the raid reinforcing the story of the character. And we talk about, like, environmental storytelling a lot. This was a really good indication of it. And there's also some of the other things too, like, one of the mechanics of the fight was him bringing down literally pieces of the enclosure around him because he's that big and powerful. He can stomp and do that. And, like, avoiding that and trying to figure out how to use the things that were being used to keep him in check to our advantage to subdue him long enough for us to get more attacks in but not keep him in stasis too long. It was this beautiful introduction balancing act of an encounter that really fed into the story of how he got here to begin with.
Yeah, and it's also, it's a Karazhan's the very first raid you're going to do in TBC. And it's definitely, it's got a lot of lore to it, and it's got the Legion and all the parts, but at the same time, it's not directly related to the story of Outland. But Magtheridon Slayer is.
Mm-hmm.
It is, you are fighting the guy that Illidan had to beat to get to be in charge in the first place. You're fighting the weapon that Illidan is using to keep the orcs loyal to him. And Illidan has been seen to be the figure who's in charge from the first moment you got to Hellfire Peninsula and went into Overlord Mokmorog's lair and were confronted by a giant, you know, eye that was directly controlled by Illidan. So this is what, like, from your leveling experience right up to this moment was all leading to you fighting Magtheridon, because it's the first actual blow you deal to the Illidari, who are the same organization that the Demon Hunters are ultimately part of, the ones with the demons that converted to Illidan's rule because, you know, he was stronger than, you know, Magtheridon, the various Broken and Naga that serve him. All of that still waits for you, but after you do Magtheridon's lair, you get basically Gruul is the next one up. And Gruul is not a demon or a fell beast or anything like that. Gruul is a descendant of the original creations of Aggramar himself.
Yep. Gruul the Dragon Killer. He is the Gron Overlord who basically is revered as a god and rules over all of the ogres of Outland. Now, keep in mind that the ogres, way back when, and we see this later on when we get to Warlords of Draenor, and we'll get there eventually, but they are, the ogres ruled with the Gorian, I think it was the Gorian Empire?
Yeah, the Gorian.
Yeah. For a long time, keeping the orcs as slaves, ruling the entirety of Outland, or Draenor at the time, for a very, very long time. But these things, the Grons, are massive beings capable of increasing in size, capable of fighting things much larger than them. And as Matt pointed out, they're creations that are descendants of Aggramar's meddling on Draenor.
Yeah, to give you, this is a real brief one. There's a lot more to this that we'll probably talk about eventually, but when Aggramar came to Draenor, he checked it to see if it had a Titan soul in it, a world soul. It didn't, but it was still capable of supporting life. If there had been a Titan soul within it, it would actually have had plenty of spirit energy to feed on, but there wasn't. So Aggramar's like, okay, I'm going to go. And as he's on his way to turn back, he notices something weird. That all that spirit energy that isn't getting used by the Titan that doesn't exist in the planet is instead going to the normal plant life, which has then developed in strange ways. And
ways that are consuming the planet.
Yeah, he looks back and says, if this continues, these plants are going to just eat everything and then they're going to die because there won't be anything to fertilize them. There won't be anything to, like, convert, you know, carbon dioxide for them. That a lot of this stuff is just going to...
The planet will eventually kill itself.
Yeah, the planet will die. I don't feel like I can do that. I can let that happen, but I don't have time to stick around here and do it myself. Plus, I'm really big, and I'd probably mess up other things if I did it. So he made Grond, and Grond was essentially a mountain that he infused with his own personal elemental force. He basically made a quick and dirty Titan Forged.
Mm-hmm.
That was a mountain. And so Grond stepped forth for the first time, the mountain that walked, the power of the world, and immediately saw its mission and took the war to the plants. This was the war of the Breakers, and I forget what the plants are called, the Primordials?
The Primordials and the Breakers, or Primals and the Breakers. Primals and the
Primals,
Breakers.
Yeah. The Primals are the plant beings. The Breakers are Grond at this point. Grond, you know, puts up an incredible fight, but he's outnumbered by just the sheer mass of
because it was what? The Colossals, which were the first ones that were under that, then the Magnaron, then the Grond?
Well, that's all coming.
Yep. Okay,
Grond is fighting the plant beings, the Primals, and he is destroyed. But the force of Aggramar can't be destroyed. The Titan's power remained. Every piece of Grond that broke off turned into a Magnaron, which are these still even more massive. They're even bigger than the Grond. They're the biggest.
I thought
it
was Colossals than the Magnaron.
No, the Magnaron and the Colossals, I'm pretty sure. But
either way,
in fact, I think the Colossals might actually be the Primals. Point being, the Magnaron led to the Grond. The Grond led to the Aggron. The Aggron led to the Ogres. And each step is kind of a devolution. If you remember the Curse of Flesh, it's actually very similar because, you know, the Magna, like, I think you are, maybe you are right about that.
Yeah, I just looked it up. So it is the Colossals that gave way to the Magnaron that gave way to the,
The Colossals are almost entirely rock.
Yes.
They're like giant chunks of rock still moving around, huge fragments of the mountain. The Magnaron are smaller and they have some fleshy bits, but they're still mostly rock. The Grond are actually at the point where the Grond seem pretty fleshy. There's nothing about them that's really rocky as such, but they're still massive. Grond are nearly as big as Magnaron. The Ogron are smaller than the Grond, but are still like,
arguably.
I mean, smarter than a Grond isn't hard. That's the other thing is as these things get smaller, they also do seem to get smarter. The Aggron were like two or three ogres tall, have a giant cyclopean eye, like their Magnaron forebears, but they are smarter, they are smaller, there are more of them. And then the ogres come about as kind of like descendants of the Aggron. The ogres start having weird mutations, like they have heads with two eyes. Sometimes they have two heads. One head has one eye and the other head has two eyes. So like they're kind of like almost having mitosis happen in their bodies. They're fully flesh beings. And then finally, the smallest and smartest, the gnomes of Draenor, are created. the most highly advanced technological inventors and innovators, the ones who develop things like nomadic, you know, hunting and tracking, pack tactics, collective organization, new weapons nobody had seen before, like spears and sticks, the orcs. And I will stand by this. They are the gnomes of Draenor.
Yep.
They are the smallest, smartest, most inventive race on Draenor.
Yep.
And again, Aggramar, in what he did with Grond, had essentially done the same kind of stuff they did on Azeroth later, but he'd done it like really quick and then had to go. It wasn't like a full-fledged process. It was just, oh, okay, this guy will take care of it. And if he doesn't take care of it, he'll break down to smaller and smaller pieces that will take care of it. I got to go. I'm still hunting for my friend Sargeras, who's out there somewhere and he's in trouble. So he took off. That all happened. And as a result, when Draenor got torn apart by Ner'zhul, the ogres and Ogron and Grond kind of survived. The bigger ones did not. Like the Magnaron, if they survived, they didn't survive on the chunk of Draenor we're on. And the Colossals, I mean, we see a few of those. I know at least one Colossal we see in Hellfire Peninsula because Kael'thas gets his hands on them.
Mm-hmm.
And uses them. But that's coming up when we talk about a different raid. But as a result of all this stuff that we just talked about, the most physically powerful being on Outland native to it were the Grond.
In particular, their leader, Gruul.
Gruul and his seven sons.
Which I think we should talk a little bit about the fact that like this is the remaining Grond that haven't died or succumbed to the decay of Outland, because at the time we get there, Outland is still in a state of slow descent, right? Like it is not completely stabilized, at least not yet. But Gruul gets his name the Dragon Killer from a very particular interaction. Now, back during, I want to say it was Warcraft 2, there was a point where Deathwing decides to take his dragon aspects, or his brood, through the dark portal and into Draenor. And at this point, he's looking for a place to store his clutch of eggs so that they can continue to grow without any interference from any of the beings back on Azeroth. And he comes across Gorgrond. The problem is, Gorgrond is still home to Gruul and the Gron who survived that Draenor slow decay so far. And here's the thing about them. They're still programmed to be highly territorial, just like Agrimmar wanted them to be way back when. Instead of fighting primals, though, at this point, now they start fighting the Black Dragonflight. And in particular, Deathwing doesn't care about them, so he doesn't directly get involved. Not necessarily. But then you have, essentially, Gruul taking dragon bodies and shoving them onto rock spikes of what will become the Blade's Edge Mountains. Because he is that big and that dangerous that he just basically takes them and shoves them on there. And in fact, when we go through that zone, there are still dragon bodies impaled onto the Blade's Edge Mountain spikes. He's that dangerous.
Yeah, and Deathwing and Gruul actually do fight.
Yes, at one point.
As part, the fight is actually arranged by the Alliance, specifically Medivh, Turalyon, and Illaria.
But it was Khadgar.
It was Khadgar. Sorry. Junior Medivh.
Junior Medivh.
Mint Medivh. Dr. Pepper Light Medivh. Anyway, yeah, Khadgar and, you know, Turalyon and Illaria realize we can't fight Deathwing, but we need the book that he's got in his lair.
But they strike a bargain.
Yeah, they get Gruul to fight him.
We should really specify. A lot of people think Gruul was just like a dumb giant. No, Gruul was intelligent, had the capability of, you know, making deals and holding conversations. Mm-hmm. It may not be like the sophistication of like gnomes or orcs, but
They weren't like the guy isn't a like sparkling conversationalist. He won't go, "Greetings, welcome to my lair. I am Gruul, and together we shall negotiate." He's like, "What want?" Me kill. But at the same time, you could talk to him. You could make a deal. Gruul was surprisingly good at punching.
Deathwing
came down thinking, okay, I'll kill this moron and I'll get on my way. And Gruul just opened a school of hitting over and over again on him. And Deathwing's like, this hurts way more than I want to deal with. Like, I can kill you, but it's going to take me a long time. And I don't really need that book anymore.
And
I'm out.
Not only that, but like during this fight too, like it should be specified that it wasn't just Gruul doing this. Yes, it did hurt, but during the fight, Khadgar was using his magic to rip off the protective armor on Deathwing so that whenever Gruul was able to land a strike, it hurt that much more. He didn't have the Elementium plates in these areas, and Gruul is smart enough to go, "Oh, that's flesh. I should punch that."
Yeah.
Like to zero in.
Deathwing took off because it was not a fight worth his time at this point. And you know, in his defense, like he had tried to kill Gruul and Gruul had not gone down.
Mm-hmm.
Gruul was a hard Gron. Like, you know, there's a reason that he was called the Dragon Killer. I mean, even when like one of Deathwing's direct children tried to take him on, he couldn't beat him. Sibellian, the son of Deathwing, the elder son of Deathwing, Nefarian's older brother, couldn't take Gruul.
Mm-hmm.
Like the most he could do was hold him at bay. Gruul was no joke.
The fight caused so much pain with Deathwing that Deathwing actually dropped the skull of Gul'dan and was forced to flee back through the dark portal. Like it was not an easy fight. Like, and that's not something that Deathwing would drop or lose track of if he had any chance at all. Deathwing knew he was outclassed.
He's like, you know, I could probably kill this jerk, and I can probably kill those jerks, but all these jerks together, it's gonna take me forever. I'm gonna get hurt. And my plans here are already done. I don't need this thing anymore. I've gotten what I intended out of this planet. And so he left. He gotten his eggs to Outland. He'd done what he intended to do, and now he was gone. But that left Gruul basically in charge of what's now called the Blade's Edge Mountains, the remains of Gorgrond and Frostfire Ridge.
Yeah, and fearful that now that Gruul had basically won his fight, right, that now there's no more common enemy to use as a bargaining chip, that Khagar and the Sons of Lothar thought that, well, he's probably going to turn on us next because he likes to fight. This is going to be bad. So they grab the Skull of Gul'dan and also beat Feet because they didn't want to be there, and I don't blame them.
And this left Gruul, you can't say he was uncontested or in charge of Outland. He just, any place he or his sons went, they were left alone.
Nobody like wanted to fight him.
Yeah, if one of the seven sons of Gruul was in an area, anybody else in that area knew to leave them alone. The Legion and later on the Illidari knew that there was no profit in fighting them.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have anything you wanted. They didn't have anything magical. They were just enormous and incredibly hard to hurt and would not stop until they or you were dead.
And there was nothing in the Blade's Edge Mountain that they needed. There was no resources that they needed to claim because they had all the other high-value places.
Yeah, they had all the places with ley line type magic. They had the places where the Sethic had once been. They had all this stuff. They had all the places where there was anything of value to get. And so they just kind of went, all right, let it, you know, just leave it alone. Leave those guys alone. It's not worth it for us to fight them. However, the Alliance and the Horde had settled in Negrand, and one of Gruul's sons was wandering around the place killing everything, so they had to deal with him.
Mm-hmm.
Once you kill one of Gruul's sons, you've declared war on Gruul.
Mm-hmm.
And so now they're like, okay, we're going into Blade's Edge. And again, the Alliance and the Horde were not fighting each other during this. I mean, occasionally there'd be some skirmishes and Hellfire, but they were more or less like, I'm going to pretend you're not here.
We have a larger threat. You're not my worry right now.
And so both the Alliance and the Horde went into Blade's Edge and made contact with the Cenarion Expedition. And were like, okay, we can't regain control. We can't gain control of this area to use it as a staging ground to go into Netherstorm unless we deal with Gruul. Because
there's another aspect of this too, right? So at the time we're starting to work on this, and after we kill one of his sons and openly declare war on Gruul the entire time, like when he was first encountered by like the Alliance and the deal was made, he had a small amount, quote unquote, of ogres that he ruled over. But during the time between then and us getting there, a lot of the Gorian Empire clans that were still scattered started flocking to Gruul as he was going to protect them. So like we're talking like the Bladespire clan and stuff like that. They all started working for Gruul. Now, not only was he a dangerous threat, he had now magic users and other things that were just as dangerous starting to flock to him.
Yeah, and it wasn't just that he was going to protect them. They were afraid of him.
And worship him as a god. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he's there. He's a figure they kind of know they descend from. They're aware of his power. I think Molgar is a really good example of an ogre who came to join his banner because he knew full well there's no way I can stand up to this guy. But if I'm doing his bidding, I can still rule the ogres, you know, and it's not like Gron, you know. Gron are not terribly hands-on rulers.
No. They want to make sure that they care about being fed, fighting, and whatever else they want to do. As long as the rest of that is taken care of, they don't really care. At least as far as I can tell.
So, you going or am I going?
Go ahead, please.
Okay. So you get to that point. It is really interesting to see like how the fight actually goes down. Because first you have to like basically wander around killing multiple others of Gruul's sons to like get various things to get you to that point. Like if you do the Blade's Edge quest lines, you'll make common cause with Sibelian and you'll fight, other of Gruul's many sons to get to the point where you can finally get in there and deal with him.
And then when you go in there, like what you see is first, it's not even Gruul, right? No, Gruul has his own chamber. It's the basically the Ogre Council.
And Molgar's little group. We should talk a little bit about Molgar.
Yeah,
Molgar is like a kind of a I don't want to say a bastard, but I don't know what else to call him. Like he's like a primitive recreation of like a Gorian Imperator. He's like the High King of the Ogres, but he's like, you know, compared to the Gorian Empire, these guys are living in squalor. They're practically beat down to savagery again. But they still do have magic, as Joe pointed out. They've even got warlocks.
Yeah, so like they have their group consists of at least his immediate retinue, Alm the Summoner, who is a warlock, Krosh Firehand, who's a fire mage, Kigler the Crazed, which I forgot what he was. I think he wasn't the priest, because that was Blind Eye the Seer. And these are all two-headed ogres that have that arcane or magical, like, ability. And they each, like, the priest one was definitely interesting, because it does call upon, like, healing and light during the entirety of the fight, which
Kigler's a straight-up mage.
Yep.
He does arcane explosion.
There you go. Kigler, yep. Okay, there you go. But yeah, and it's
also sheeps people.
He does also sheep people. I forgot about that. But it's also interesting, too, because, like, High King Malgar, when you say that he's, like, a weird, almost, like, mutation of what the former things are, it is also fascinating. One, he's a single-headed ogre. Two, he's very spiky, which I always struck me as odd. Like, he doesn't have a crown. His crown is literally the horns that are, like, sprouting out around his head. But he's
got one eye.
And he does have one eye, so...
Essentially, he's like some kind of ogre slash ogron cross.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's on the way back to being an ogron. He's not quite an ogre anymore. They call them ogre lords, but he's basically just a huge, violent, practically insane ogre who is not all there. But you know, he's straight up. He is bad news. And when you get past him, you know, then you have to fight Gruul himself. So that's the best part, is your reward for defeating this powerful group of, you know, ogre magicians who draw upon the traditions of ancient Goria and this mutated half ogre, half Gron thing, is to fight Gruul himself, who is like, it's funny, because the two big raid encounters of BC that are not Karazhan are essentially two of the biggest physical presences you're going to see.
Yeah, and in Gruul's case, and during the encounter, like, you get to see something in that aspect that I don't think we've really seen in a fight since. First of all, it's a circular chamber with the one exit out, and inside of this chamber, inside of this almost like arena-like fight that you are facing with Gruul, every 30 seconds that you are fighting him, he gets bigger, and he gets bigger and bigger, increasing the amount of damage that he does the entire time. And that doesn't sound so bad at first, but this is a multiplicative buff that is given to him that can stack up to 30 times. And when he reaches stack number 30, if he is not taken down, he stays at that increase. So every size increase is 15% more damage, and his size gets 10% bigger. So at 300% size, and I don't even remember, like, what, 450 or some odd percentage, or whatever it actually works out to, for 5 minutes. That's his biggest, his most maximum, his rage-induced, the size that he was when he was fighting Deathwing. And that is a phenomenal, again, that environmental storytelling. Because as the fight goes on, the longer you are fighting him, the more dangerous it becomes. And that is just absolutely fascinating, because that parallels exactly what happened with the fight with him and Deathwing. It was the longer that Deathwing was engaged, the more dangerous Gruul became. The larger he became, the harder he hit. And it wasn't just Khadgar ripping off the armor plates at that point. Yeah, that helped, but it was... the more you fought him, the angrier he got. He hulked up. He just got bigger and more dangerous. And you have only a certain amount of time to deal with him before you cannot deal with him anymore. And it was one of those things where a lot of people, a lot of groups struggled with it because of it. It was a very, very burn heavy fight. It was in a time when, like, you didn't have basically a raid wide bloodlust or heroism. And, you know, you had basically just gotten the Alliance side had just gotten shaman, and so you had, if you had a full five groups, you had five shaman, or at least you tried to, so that you could maximize the DPS on bloodlust, so that you could literally take this thing down, because if you didn't at that time, you just couldn't. And it was fascinating how much you had to leverage and work together as a group, maximizing everything you had, at least at first. It definitely became a lot easier later on, but at first it was the fight. It was the DPS check. And it really was one of those things that was informed very heavily by the storytelling and the lore behind the character itself. And I always really enjoyed that, because a lot of fights, they seem difficult, but they don't seem dangerous, if that makes sense. A lot of things we've had since then, yeah, these are hard fights and difficult, but there's really not this sense of like ever foreboding danger. And I'm not just talking about enraged timers or berserk timers.
Yeah, because it wasn't exactly an enraged timer. There was two, like the growth mechanic Joe mentioned, there's also shatter.
Yeah.
Because Gruul would stone the whole group.
Turn you the stone. Like we put
what's called stoned was the debuff. He put in a thing called Gronlord's Grasp, where he's essentially like, you know, hitting out this zone wide knockback, and you get a debuff on you when he does it.
He's commanding basically the ground to sort of eat you a little.
And when he does it five times, you basically get petrified in place. And then he breaks the shatter that's holding you and does this spike of damage. It's physical damage. It starts at like 1,100 if you're within 15 feet of him, and then it way spikes up if you're further away
like
from him.
Like 9K, which was massive at the time.
Yeah, and because he's got growth going, growth increases damage done by 15% every 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it stacks up to 30 times. So think about 15% times 30.
And let me throw this out there for you guys too, that are thinking, oh, this would have been fine. We had all these abilities that made us immune to stuff. Yeah, nope. No, they thought about this. So Divine Shield, Ice Block, all of that stuff. This went through that. You could not avoid it.
Yeah, the only possible way to avoid it was to avoid Gronlord's Grasp so you didn't get stoned. And there was only a very small amount of ways to avoid it. Complete immunity effects, not Blessing of Protection.
Cloak of Shadows.
Cloak of Shadows and other complete immunity effects could protect you from a stack of Gronlord's Grasp. But you were going to get stacked up eventually. It just
delayed it.
Yeah, and if he gets stoned out, he's going to do it. It just might not do damage to you because you didn't get the full stack. And there's just, as he's growing, the damage he's doing with this is going up. So, yeah, the damage he does hitting the tank is pretty bad, but it's the damage from Shatter that will wipe your raid because it will become impossible to mitigate. And when you combine that, because we're not even done, when you combine that with Hurtful Strike, which is the thing where he suddenly, the next highest list after the tank, he will hit that guy for 12,350 to 13,650 damage, which can be reduced by armor and defensive stance at the time and so forth. But so basically you need either a druid or a warrior tank to absorb this thing.
And heaven forbid that you were a hunter or somebody that managed to get second on the aggro table in that moment, you were just paced.
Yeah, you had to be below both the MT and the OT. This is why, abilities like at the time, I think it was just misdirection. I don't know if the rogues had tricks yet. Maybe they did.
They did. And then you had Wind Shear also reduce like your threat level as well.
Yeah. You needed to use abilities to basically throw threat onto the main tank and the off tank to keep them above. You wanted them, they had to be at the top. And you needed to make sure the OT stayed below the MT, because if the OT climbed above the MT, then the MT was going to take Hurtful Strike and it would kill them, because it was every 20 seconds.
Yeah.
You couldn't have that thing going to the tank every 20 seconds, in addition to the sheer amount of damage Gruul was doing just punching people.
We're coming up on time, so I just want to kind of bring this home. These are two encounters
the thing you were talking about before, absolutely.
They absolutely inform an encounter based off of story and lore and force players to sort of engage in sort of that heroic moment for each of them. And it's one of those things where it really is enjoyable to remember how it was back then to a certain extent, because it was for us, like people like Matt and myself, you are getting to play through a lore heavy encounter that wasn't watered down or wasn't changed or and is very much as deadly as it really meant to be. And especially like Gruul in particular was one of those moments where I was very giddy to see it, because I was like, I remember the story of him fighting Deathwing and him punching him and making Deathwing go, nope, this is something I should not deal with. And then it comes back later, because when you go and actually fight Deathwing, you remember, no, I beat up Gruul. I took care of that problem, and he took care of you, so I'm going to go ahead and take care of you too. And it just sort of feeds into that story of your character throughout all of these years, if you've been playing that long, of the deeds that you've accomplished and the dangers that you have survived to get there. And there are several more instances of it. We'll talk about these more with some of the later raids or as we progress
before
through.
Before we move on, I want to mention two other raid-sized encounters that happened in BC that are kind of off on their own. There's Doomlord Kazak, who is in Hellfire Peninsula up on a platform where the Legion has a high presence, and Doomwalker. Who's literally patrolling the area right in front of the Black Temple. I don't know when we'll have time to talk about them, but in terms of environmental storytelling, they both serve a real purpose. Doomlord Kazak is the same Kazak who was a world boss in Classic.
Mm-hmm.
He comes back as an even more powerful version of himself. But he's up there. You can't get him down, so you can't kite him anywhere. Like,
they moved him on his own little floating island in the middle of nowhere for that very reason.
Yeah, you can't kite him, so you can't kite him to Shattrath and have him fight, like, the Naru, thankfully. Like, a doll. He doesn't get to do that. I remember people actually would kite things to fight a doll.
Yes.
I think Doomwalker, they kited Doomwalker
over
to a doll.
They would kite Doomwalker, yeah.
Yeah, but Doomwalker, like I said, is right around in front of the Black Temple. And at the time, Black Temple wasn't open yet. And one of the things in lore was that you had to get past Doomwalker.
Yep, because it was guarding. It was essentially guarding the only way in.
Well, it wasn't really guarding it. It was trying to get its way in because it was a Legion thing trying to beat its way into the temple.
Yeah.
So it was, but it was still going to attack you if you tried to get past it. So yeah, there was a lot of that to this expansion that I wanted to at least mention those fights. I don't think we have time to really go over them, but
no,
I just want to make sure that they were mentioned.
But we'll maybe spend some time talking about them a little bit in a future episode. But for right now, Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/BlizzardWatch. Your continued support means this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. And as a reminder, all of us at Blizzard Watch stand with the employees of Activision Blizzard in demanding change for a better tomorrow and a safer working environment.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.